Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. Dismissal is the default response to khayal, the preeminent genre of North Indian classical music, well before we get to know what khayal is and vaguely term its strangeness classical music. Those who later become acquainted with its extraordinary melodiousness forget that on the initial encounter it had sounded unmelodious. These words are part of the introduction to Amit Chowdhury's newest book, Finding the Raga, an improvisation on Indian music, published earlier this year by New York Review Books. The book is part guide to Indian music, part memoir of Chowdhury's life, part examination of modern culture. Amit Chowdhury is the author of 7 novels, several collections of short stories, poetry, and essays, 1 nonfiction work, and a critical study of D.H. Lawrence's poetry. He has received the Commonwealth Writers Prize, the Betty Trask Award, the Encore Prize, the L.A. Times Book Prize, and the Sahitya Akademi Award, among other accolades. He is also a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and holds the titles of Professor of Contemporary Literature at the University of East Anglia in England and Professor of Creative Writing at Ashoka University in India. In addition to his writing, he is also a singer in the North Indian classical tradition and a composer and performer in a project that brings together the raga, blues, and jazz with a variety of other musical traditions. Today, I'll ask Amit to explain what makes Indian music so special, both in general and to his life. We'll explore how Indian music influenced the writing of this most recent book, and how his musical experiences in India and abroad have affected how he sees the world. So, Amit, thank you so much for joining me today on the show. Perhaps it's best to start with Indian music. Could you perhaps describe the fundamentals of Indian classical music for our listeners?
So, Indian music is, of course, a huge, very broad term. So I think, as you said towards the end, you're talking about classical music. And again, within classical music, I mean, there are at least 2 major recognized traditions in India. The one that I kind of write about, the one that I'm a practitioner in, is North Indian classical music. But there is also the tradition of Carnatic music, which is practiced in the south of India. So I'm not going to now be referring to Carnatic music. I'm going to be talking about North Indian classical music when I refer to Indian classical music. And those who know Indian music through instrumentalists like Ravi Shankar and Ali Akbar Khan, know it through the North Indian classical tradition. Having said that, I mean, I should confess that I myself got to know North Indian classical music through these instrumentalists, first and foremost, even prior to my discovering the traditional in vocal music and khayal, which is the primary modern genre of Indian classical vocal music. Before I became firstly interested and then won over by that particular form and began to want to sort of become a practitioner myself, I got to know Indian classical music, North Indian classical music, through Ravi Shankar, through the sitar, Ali Akbar Khan, the sarod. And that's partly because, in the 70s, that was the primary form in which this music was known to the world, including India and kind of India that I came from, which was Bombay, educated middle class or upper middle class. We lived at something of a distance from Indian classical music. So in a sense, it came to us via the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, people of my generation and my background, I'm not talking about my parents over here. And because it came to us via the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, what we heard first was the sitar and Ravi Shankar. Nicholas, you wanted to say something.
Well, I mean, perhaps maybe we can talk about, I guess, your long experience with Indian music throughout your life. Could you tell us more about your history with Indian music as you relate it in the book?
Yeah. So as I was saying, I mean, I discovered this music partly through Ravi Shankar, Ali Akbar Khan, and the intermediaries there were George Harrison and the Beatles, etc. Who we were listening to, and I was playing the acoustic guitar. I was interested in pop and rock, and then American folk music, and wrote songs myself and performed them. At the age of 16, my mother, who was a great singer of Tagore songs, and we were in Bombay. She was also singing Hindi devotionals called bhajans. In 1978, a new teacher to teach her these devotionals arrived in the house called Govind Prasad Jaipurwale. And he was, besides a teacher of various kinds of music, a great classical, North Indian classical musician himself. That North Indian classical training and temperament, I think, informed everything he sang, including these devotionals. So I began to listen to these devotionals and the way he was teaching them to my mother, and I began to notice the kind of variations and the modulations which he brought to bear on his interpretation of the song. So the songs weren't kind of just straightforward interpretations. Not that they had ever been straightforward interpretations, because there is a degree of modulation in any Indian singing, but in Govind Ji's case, I called him Govind Ji. The kind of instance of modulation of changing a phrase. Of what is called, what we might call improvisation, was just a kind of more notable and frequent occurrence, the kind of restiveness that made him change phrases from line to line musically. And I became fascinated with this, and I was already opening my ears to Indian classical music. And you asked me earlier, what is Indian classical music? I would say at the basis of Indian classical music is the voice. And it's the voice which is capable of producing the subtlest of modulations, of interpretations, of changes, which is why even sitar players like Vilayat Khan tried to emulate the voice and create a style of pulling strings in a way that produced very complicated and nuanced bent notes. And called it the Gaiki Ang, or the singing style, a very complex style of pulling the string sideways in order to create really very, very subtle bent notes of a high degree of complexity, say when compared to the bent notes produced by the blues guitar. And this is because they were trying to follow the modulations of the voice. Even the bent notes in the blues guitar, I think, is trying to emulate the richness of blues singing. So that's one example you have over there in African American stroke, the Western tradition of the instrument trying to emulate the voice. So what I'm trying to say here is a classical tradition based fundamentally on the voice. The voice it is that brings us the two elements of the compositions that are explored in minute detail and with full imaginative engagement in this tradition. And those two elements are rag being the arrangement of notes, a particular form of ascending a particular arrangement of notes and descending. And sometimes the ascent is never straightforward. You go up and you come down again and you go up again until you reach the upper tonic, and then you come down again. And the ascent and the descent might approach the same notes in different ways. Some notes may not be sung in the ascent. Some may not be sung in the descent. That is a rag. I mean, that might be a kind of not immediately comprehensible way, but the only way I can think of of defining a rag in a few seconds. And the other element of this music is tal, or tala, as it is spelled in English, tal, which means rhythm, tempo, the time cycle. And over here basically means a variety of rhythmic time cycles to which the compositions and the are set, and which are also explored to a high degree of complexity and improvised upon. Talas are also being improvised upon constantly, just as the raga is, that is, the melodic and the incarnation of notes that raga implies, and the conceptual underpinnings of that exploration is as important as this time cycle, which creates a kind of parameter, creates restrictions, and with restrictions, possibilities of improvisation and departure. And this is at the core of Indian classical music, and the voice and its tonality bring these elements to us through compositions. And then come the other elements which are there alongside the vocalist, tabla, sarangi, harmonium as accompaniment. And then, of course, there's the whole variety of instrumental music which brings to this domain things that only a particular instrument can, contributions that only a particular instrument can bring to that particular domain, to this domain.
So you've had experience both in the space of Indian music and also in the space of Western music. I think the phrase lapsed Canadian singer-songwriter pops up a lot, both in your book and in descriptions in your bio, for example. So you've operated in both spaces, and your book's also filled with I hesitate to call them comparisons, but discussions of both the differences between Indian and Western music, but also their similarities. I note there's the chapter on the ah sound, which you point to in John Lennon singing. The last chapter is about all your mishearings, where you are hearing the connections and the similarities between, say, Hendrix and Indian music. So I guess kind of I wonder if you could talk a bit more about your experience in both of these spaces and the differences that you saw, and also I guess maybe the connections you now see between these two spaces.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, when I was growing up, when I was very small, I would have overheard Hindi film music, which itself is a very creative melange, or used to be, of it is maybe not so any longer, but it's one of the great 20th century expressions of what is possible when various music traditions come together to create a 3 or 4 minute song. I think it sort of anticipates and in some ways outshines some of the things that begin to take place in Western pop music after 1967 with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. So I would have overheard that, but because there would have been a class prejudice against Hindi film music at that time, it wouldn't have really been a part of my daily life. So what music would have been part of my daily life? My mother's singing of the Tagore song, which was part of one of the features of polite Bengali society. However, since I was growing up in Bombay, which is in Maharashtra and not in Bengal, there would be a degree of distance from the Tagore song, which now I see as being a welcome distance, which allowed me to really value it later in life rather than have it as a kind of norm in my life, something that I was growing up with as a kind of almost as a religious observance in my daily life, a secular but religious observance. So I would have grown up with my mother's singing Tagore songs, but which itself, I have to say, is an Indian response, a particularly characteristic Indian response that prefigures many experiments in Hindi film music and other kinds of music, but a response to Western, Indian, other traditions coming together to create a song. It's an extraordinary expression of that. So, but since it was my mother who was singing it, I would have ignored it. It's only later on, gradually, that I got to understand what my mother was doing, what her achievement was. But as a child, I obviously would have ignored it. At the age of 6 or 7 or 8, at the age of 6, maybe I would have heard The Sound of Music and My Fair Lady. I was much taken with those songs. A year later or so, when a lifetime had passed, I would have heard The Who, because my father bought a hi-fi set, I think in 1969 or 70, I can't remember exactly when, we got a couple of complimentary records as gifts alongside the purchase of the hi-fi set, and one of them was The Best of The Who. So I remember listening to Substitute and I Can See for Miles, Pictures of Lily. I also discovered from one of those complimentary records, I think the Bee Gees, the early Bee Gees, whom I liked a lot. The falsetto singing disco Bee Gees were a great kind of devastating blow to me when they came back together and sang Saturday Night Fever, the songs for Saturday Night Fever. That would have been my initial sort of entry into the world of pop. And then the Beatles, of course. And then around the age of 11 or 12, I would have wanted to learn the guitar. And I think what I did first was a friend of mine and I, this friend had a wonderful record collection. So we listened to music together. We argued over music. He also had this amazing encyclopedia of pop called The Story of Pop. He had all kinds of goodies in his house. So he used to live in a place called Breach Candy. And in Breach Candy, there was, I think, some place called the Bombay School of Music. I can't even remember what it was called. But we both decided we'd go together and learn how to play the guitar. Now, the thing about my friend is he loved music, but he wasn't actually very musical. Anyway, so he and I went off to this place with our guitars, and to my dismay, we had to start learning sheet music. That in itself wasn't a problem, but learning from sheet music meant learning from the, as a beginner, how to read music. And among the first pieces that we were asked to learn up, as it were, was a piece called Likely Row. I don't know if you've heard this piece, this song. So anyway, it went Likely Row, Likely Row, Likely Row. And I think the notes were very simple, but we had to, which is why it was given to us. And we had to learn how to read music through Likely Row. And from a very nice teacher, I think, called Bonnie Da Costa. And I remember being bored immediately from the whole kind of pointless exercise of having to learn how to read music in order to play Likely Row. So the other thing that worried me was that because of my laziness, I was having, and my resistance to Likely Row, I was having trouble picking up the music from that piece of sheet music. But my friend, who wasn't really musical, had learned it up, and he was making faster progress than I was. So here was my friend who was not very musical, but he was learning how to play Likely Row, and being able to play it simply by reading those notes on the page, while I was unable to. So I thought, there's something wrong with this. And I withdrew. And then I began to informally learn how to play music from somebody who offered to teach me music via chords and songs that I wanted to sing. So I never learned how to read music in the Western system. I of course, felt kind of relieved later on and almost vindicated to hear how few of the great pop musicians knew how to read music. That was a good alibi for me. And but I picked up the guitar very fast then. And then by the age of 16, I was composing stuff, 15 or 16. And I was never interested in Western classical music again because of my personal prejudices against the people who were listening to Western classical music in Bombay. Bear in mind that Bombay produced people like Zubin Mehta from the Parsi community in Western classical music, and also Freddie Balsara or Freddie Mercury in rock. I looked upon the people who claim to listen to Western classical music with pleasure with suspicion and prejudice, and therefore never listened to it myself. So my grounding in Western music was the rock tradition. But by the time I was 15 or so, I was listening, I was immersing myself in Buffalo Springfield, Neil Young, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and Joni Mitchell. Therefore, I say I was on my way to becoming a Canadian singer-songwriter. And it's through Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, that I got my taste for a particular kind of unresolved harmonic setting, a mood in music that was slightly hypnotic and trance-like, with the kind of sustained fourth chords and the add ninth chords and Joni Mitchell's open tunings, which at that time I was not aware of, and then her increasing interest in complex tonalities and jazz. And it's at this time that I was also began in this increasing self-imposed isolation to listen to Western classical music, to Beethoven, from an old kind of collection that my father had bought, but listened very little to, of Beethoven conducted, the symphonies conducted by Herbert von Karajan. And at this time, I was also beginning to listen to Indian classical music with greater attention, to Govind Prasad Jaipurwale, to music that I was discovering by chance around me, including Marathi language programs, which at another time in my life I would never have deigned to listen to, but I was now listening to in order to listen to these musicians. So Sunday mornings, programs where these musicians would be interviewed, and I heard Kishori Amonkar and Bhimsen Joshi on either consecutive Sundays or two Sundays apart, 10 o'clock in the morning on this program called Pratibha Ani Pratima, not able to understand a word of what they were saying in Marathi, so kind of deracinated we were in Bombay. I'm not using that word in a pejorative way, but just to describe the kind of life we were leading. So many of us, whether we speak Marathi or Hindi or English or not, leave our cocooned lives in different ways. So there I was, not able to understand Marathi growing up in Bombay, but suddenly discovering this music, Indian classical music, and then through recordings. At that time, I began to kind of understand that there was a difference in the way that Western classical music, it had a different impact on me in the way I was conceiving of its relationship to the world. And Indian classical music had a different way of defining its and the listener's relationship to the world. This was the primary kind of contrast in my head at that time.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So I'd like to maybe ask about, talk about the book now. You know, the book is subtitled An Improvisation on Indian Music. And I know authors oftentimes don't get to pick the title and subtitle of their book, or at least it's a joint venture. But I thought if you could maybe explain why you decided to call the book An Improvisation. Are there elements of, I guess, an approach to creating something? The approaches to creating Indian music that you try to emulate in writing Finding the Raga?
Because my structures are always quite open-ended and loose, and whether I'm writing fiction or non-fiction, I've been asked right from the beginning of my public life as a published writer, whether, especially by those who know that I'm also a musician, whether I am trying to sort of capture or approximate or borrow something from the structure of the rag in my writings. And I've always said no, because I have not done any such thing consciously. Over here, I think the subtitle, one possible subtitle could have been An Essay on Indian Music. Another possible subtitle could have been the other possible subtitle was the one I chose, An Improvisation on Indian Music. There could have been other subtitles too, but you know, one was trying to sort of suggest to the reader and hint to them that this is not a manual on Indian classical music, nor is it a conventional introduction to Indian classical music. That if you come to the book thinking that, you know, somebody is going to tell me stuff, introducing me as in a textbook or a manual to a particular musical system, they are going to be disappointed, because what they're going to come up against is a reflection and a critique and a thought process. So what I'm trying to put down here is a thought process, or several thought processes, and many of the discoveries are made in the process of writing what I'm writing. It's not as if I have a set of things I already know that I then decide to write about, nor is it that I already know how to write about this particular set of things. The writing sort of is an exploration of how one might be able to write about this. And this means over here, not only Indian classical music, but why I'm writing about Indian classical music. Why me? And in what way answering that question, why and why me, can illuminate in certain ways this question of discovering this music, what it means, can illuminate these questions in a way that wouldn't be possible if I left that out. If I just pretended to be a kind of neutral commentator, I would not be able to go to those places that I am able to in this book. One thing I have said in the book where I do make a sort of comparison between what one does as a singer in the North Indian classical tradition and what I do as a writer is this notion of improvisation being deferral, that is, to not finish singing the rag in 2 minutes, but to amplify it, to revisit its each detail, its each one of its phrases, from a variety of perspectives, to evade maybe delineating its structure immediately and be done with it. And in that evasion, to show the possibility of imaginative rethinking, reworking, and beauty, to show how what might be seen as prevarication, to show how that is intended, how prevarication is intended as an effect to create beauty, and to show the various ways in which prevarication is possible, in terms of evading the notes that you're supposed to sing, coming to them from oblique sort of directions, and then arriving at them. This is what improvisation or elaboration in khayal of a rag is all about. So in that sense, in my writing too, I don't think the basic structure is of interest to me, or the basic theme or the basic content, as much as discovering ways in which arriving at this structure ways in which they are that's possible. That process for me then becomes the book. So in that sense, yes, I mean there might be a connection with the way one approaches a rag, but it's not something I'm trying to do consciously.
I think I have one more question for you, I think, before we end our conversation. If someone wanted to explore the styles, the things about the khayal and other Indian music that you discuss in your book, what should they look for? Where should they look?
If they want to explore these things I've talked about, is that what you're?
Yes. If they want to experience kind of the the styles, the themes, the concepts you talk about in your book in Indian music. What are some things that they should look for?
I mean, firstly, I mean they could always go to the to YouTube and look up some of the recordings. I'm sorry that I haven't provided a list of links or recordings to go to, in the book. But that is something that they could do. I mean, there are those names over there. They could begin by looking at the shorter, briefer renditions. From the 78 RPM recordings, where somebody's actually doing quite a bit in 3 minutes to show what a rag can be and what a khayal can be. And through that, they could also get a sense of tonality, timbre, the texture of the voice that makes this singing so absorbing, so beautiful. I think they could also look at Indian miniature paintings. bring themselves into contact a little bit with that world where the universe and the world is its cosmology are celebrated, whether it's in a painting to do with an episode from the Ramayana, or it's a painting of a garden or a woman, or it's a more kind of, it's an older kind of cosmology where various gods and goddesses or spiritual experiences are being shown. To see that and keep in conjunction the developments in modernism in cinema, where nothing seems to be happening but a lot is happening in the films of Satyajit Ray or Abbas Kiarostami, or go to post-impressionism, the beginnings of post-impressionism in Monet, and look at how representation of themes are fading away into something else. That would create, I think, the atmosphere from which these various innovations in music have arisen. Keep in mind that Indian classical music is old, but also it's new. A lot of what we are hearing now as Indian classical music are modernist innovations, especially these departures from easily recognizable, hummable forms. The strangeness of the music that I talk about is often it's strange to Indians as well, to most Indians as well. These are the results of modernist innovations. So put them in that context to come into contact with this very kind of astonishing departure and aberration and opening out into other ways of experiencing the world than the representational, the thematic.
So with that, thank you for listening to our interview with Amit Chowdhury, author of Finding the Raga, an Improvisation on Indian Music. One actual final question. Amit, what's next for you, and where can people find your work?
What's next for me? I'm trying to write a novel. That's the kind of feeble answer, that writers give. I'm writing my next book. But it's true as well. And like most true answers are boring, is boring. My work, hopefully some of the books are in bookshops, they're online. My music, a lot of it is up on YouTube. Go to YouTube to listen to my Indian classical recordings over 2.5 decades, or my recordings in the experimental tradition. This is not fusion and found music. Soon there will be stuff up from my radio broadcasts of from those years when I was learning Indian music, but also I was still a Canadian singer songwriter in the making. Those songs which I composed them at that time, a couple of them are up on YouTube. More will be up soon, at part of an album, I hope, of radio broadcasts from that time. And some of it is on Apple Music, iTunes, Spotify. You can find it there as well.
Well, I look forward to hearing more about your next novel. You can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at @NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at @BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. We hope you subscribe to listen to the Asian Review Books podcast now on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends. If you want to support us continuing to interview those writing in, around, and about Asia. Stay tuned to learn more about who's coming up next on the show. But before then, thank you, Amit, for joining me today.
Thank you so much. Thanks. Bye-bye.